Welcome to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. The origins of ISIS has become a topic of debate in the U.S. presidential election, and this week's episode focuses on that topic. We'll hear from Joby Warrick, author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. He is a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter at The Washington Post. He will be in conversation with Corey Shockey, research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. This event was recorded in San Francisco before a World Affairs audience. And now to our moderator.
So it is a privilege to be with all of you here at the World Affairs Council this evening, and for those of you listening to us on the radio, for a conversation with author and journalist Joby Warrick. I'm an enormous fan of his work, both his reporting and the extraordinary book. I don't see a copy of it anywhere near, but Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS, which is going to be the subject for our conversation tonight. So won't you join me in thanking Joby for joining us here in San Francisco this evening? Joby, the first question I'd like to ask is to have you tell us a little bit of the story that drives the narrative of this very good nonfiction book, which is, how is it Ahmad Fahid becomes Zarqawi?
Yeah, it's probably the most unlikely story that you can dream up for somebody becoming the leader of a terrorist organization. And that's what really attracted me to this character. Even before we've heard of ISIS and even before the Syrian conflict began, I was very fascinated with this individual because he's someone who was underestimated and unexpected throughout his entire life and career. He started out as a misfit Jordanian kid who was a juvenile delinquent, a thug, essentially, a drug abuser, someone who was in trouble with the law frequently, ends up getting arrested quite a bit, gets tattoos, not a religious guy by any stretch. And he ends up becoming radicalized, partly because he goes to Afghanistan, as many people of his generation did, to try to fight to become a mujahideen, gets religion, learns sort of ideology from contemporaries of Osama bin Laden, learns that he's very good at killing people, which becomes useful later on, and then just through a bunch of improbable circumstances ends up being the leader of the insurgency in Iraq, what we used to call Al-Qaeda in Iraq. That's really sort of the parent organization of what's now the Islamic State. So really unexpected person to be at the head, but he had absolutely the charisma and the skill set he needed to be this great terrorist leader.
One of the stories the perspectives you give the most vibrancy to in the book is the way that he pioneered the gruesome video coverage that has become such a hallmark of the terrorist campaigns in the Middle East. Will you tell us a little bit more about that?
This is one of the surprising things about him, because he was barely literate. I mean, he just dropped out of high school, so this was not a very smart guy, but he was smart enough to figure out that this new internet weapon or tool that was available beginning in the early 2000s, broadband was becoming popular, was just the perfect way to spread his propaganda. And rather than doing traditional things, he did plenty of bombings and that sort of thing, but he figured out that the most viscerally horrible thing you can expose someone to is the execution of a single individual captured on video. And so he was the one that grabbed an American that he happened to capture off the street, a young Philadelphia guy who was just in Iraq looking to make a business for himself, puts him in the orange jumpsuit, which is all so familiar to us now, and beheads him with his own hand on camera, and the video went viral around the world. This happened in 2004. It was really the moment when a lot of Americans began looking at the Iraq conflict and really saying, what are we into here? So it was kind of one of these almost like Tet Offensive sort of, opinion shifts very quickly after this takes place. But this was his idea, and his followers in ISIS are doing exactly the same thing, except on a grander scale, and they're using all these new social media that weren't available to Zarqawi. But it's a pretty brilliant strategy.
Yeah, it very much is. Can you talk a little bit about how for Osama bin Laden and the Al-Qaeda founders, I mean, you really do see a departure with Zarqawi, not just in style, but also in the willingness to target fellow Muslims.
Yeah.
Talk about how that friction plays out between the two organizations.
Yeah, there's an interesting interaction throughout Zarqawi's career, because in Afghanistan, he wanted to be part of that world. He wanted to be part of bin Laden's group. He goes back to Afghanistan, skipping ahead a prison term. He spent some time in prison in Jordan. Goes to Afghanistan to try to join bin Laden's movement. Bin Laden rejects him as being too crazy for him,
right.
Too extreme, too inflexible in his ideology. Because he's someone who embraces this idea. The term in Arabic is takfiri, which means that you have, you're not just an extreme ideologue, but you believe you have the ability to condemn another Muslim to death as an apostate. And bin Laden didn't want to go that far. He wanted to kind of have an inclusive movement. He wanted to sort of politically draw other Muslims to himself. Zarqawi didn't care about that. He was a brute. And so he was very happy to condemn people, to execute Shia Muslims, to even kill Sunnis who weren't on his side. And so that becomes a big problem for bin Laden, because they see this as damaging the brand, these suicide bombings and these beheadings and all these terrible things that Zarqawi was doing were just repugnant even to Al-Qaeda. And so they told him to stop, but he wouldn't do it. He just continued to go his own way. That same rift is what you see now between Al-Qaeda proper, Al-Qaeda core, Zawahiri's organization, and ISIS today. They're really at war with each other over tactics, over inclusiveness, over this sort of insistence on being able to condemn and kill people who don't agree with you. And now you see them very much fighting each other in Syria, as they're fighting the Assad government, which is quite striking.
Yeah. One of the saddest parts of the story you tell so cogently in the book is the way that Zarqawi saw advantage to fomenting Shia-Sunni friction, that is, fostering an intersectarian war. Mm. Talk a little bit about that, and I'd especially like to know your judgment about the counterfactual. That is, if you don't have Zarqawi, do you think, even with al-Maliki as prime minister in Iraq taking such stridently sectarian policies, if you don't have Zarqawi fostering the sectarian conflict, do you think Iraq might have had a different trajectory?
Mm. Two very good questions. I think I'll take the second one first. It's I believe that Zarqawi ends up being an indispensable character in the story of the insurgency and the story of what happened afterward, because there would have been insurgency, and I think it would have been more of a secularist, Ba'athist, former military officers in Saddam's army who were unemployed and unhappy. So you would have had this ongoing campaign, and maybe a very serious one. What Zarqawi brought to the conflict was this marriage of extreme ideology, so the religious fanatics and the Ba'athists together, because he becomes this, everybody's looking for a leader, everybody's looking for someone with a vision, and he becomes that person. And what he does early on, a couple of interesting things, he starts attacking strategic targets that are really going to hurt the United States in a way that no one really anticipated at the time. He attacks Arab embassies, he attacks the Red Cross, kills the leader of the UN mission in Iraq, starts going after all these NGOs and driving them out of the country. So any organization that could have supported us, given us sort of cover of legitimacy in our occupation of Iraq, they get chased out by Zarqawi very effectively. And the second thing he does is go after the Sunni-Shia fault line. It's a majority Shia country, but Sunnis and Shia have lived together relatively peacefully for decades in Iraq. But he starts going after them, goes after the biggest mosques, the biggest shrines, the leaders of the Shia sect in Iraq. And so in essence, he essentially chases away all the folks who could have helped us, and then he ignites a civil war very deliberately around us. And through that, he very much brings the U.S. occupation to the point in 2004, 2005, where it looks like we've lost. Before the surge happened, there was a real consideration about, do we just declare victory and go home, because it was such a mess. And we can really blame Zarqawi for a lot of that, I think.
And it sort of seems like the great man theory of history, right? If you don't have Zarqawi, mm-hmm. you might have had a different trajectory in Iraq, a more cooperative trajectory in Iraq, a less violent trajectory in Iraq.
Yeah, absolutely. And every time that things could have gone a different way, it seems like history intervened in Zarqawi's favor. It's just a remarkable career path where he just keeps getting lucky breaks, and we keep missing him. We've had so many times to try to catch him or kill him. Even before the war started, we knew where he was. We knew he was trouble. there was discussions on cabinet level meetings about whether we go after him before the war started, and then it was essentially voted down because we had a war plan that was on track and we didn't want to get it off track and maybe get Saddam Hussein up and doing bad things before we were ready. So once again, he escapes, what could have been a history-changing moment.
One of the hardest things for me that I did not know, actually, before I read your book, was the way that Secretary of State Powell, in his testimony presentation at the United Nations, I did not realize he mentioned Zarqawi and that served to give him stature. Yeah. In the jihadist community. So to some extent, we are also complicit in his standing.
Yeah, this is another of these really remarkable twists of history. So Zarqawi in 2003 was a wannabe, but he really wasn't a very important terrorist figure. He, bin Laden had rejected him, allowed him to set up his own terrorist camp in sort of extreme western Afghanistan, and eventually after 9/11 and after the military incursion into Afghanistan. What's interesting is that he wasn't anyone, and then when the administration is trying to make the case for invasion before the United Nations Security Council, Zarqawi suddenly becomes the poster child. Colin Powell literally puts his picture up on a big screen before the UN Security Council and says, this is this nexus between terrorism and dictatorship that we're worried about. This is the operative who's inside Iraq. We think he has relations with Saddam's intelligence service. Turns out he didn't have any relation at all. And yet this is the case we made. And the result of it was that Zarqawi became very famous. He became a very big deal in the jihadist community almost overnight. So suddenly he's getting money, he's getting recruits, he's getting people traveling to Iraq to be part of his movement. That probably wouldn't have happened, at least on such a short order, if he had not been made famous, I think, by that speech.
And let's pull the story forward a little bit to the next iteration in the rise of ISIS, which is Baghdadi. Talk about what he learns from Zarqawi, how the movement changes as you move from the insurgency in Iraq over into the war in Syria.
And spoiler alert, Zarqawi is killed. So I'm sorry if you haven't gotten that far in the book yet. So 2006, we finally get him. And it looks like we're very hopeful for a brief period of time that maybe we've defeated this movement or we're getting very close. It turns out it wasn't that easy. But there's a period of time between 2006 and 2008 where other leaders come to the fore. We get better at finding them. We get better at going after them and sort of killing the leadership of this al-Qaeda in Iraq organization. One of the characters that's moving up through the ranks to this time is this man who we call Baghdadi. Not his real name, of course. They don't use their names. But he's essentially a religious scholar. ISIS, and even back in Zarqawi's time, the al-Qaeda in Iraq, they need religious cover for the stuff they do, because the stuff they do isn't very Islamic, it turns out. But al-Qaeda, or Zarqawi, didn't care. He didn't care that suicide bombings aren't really kosher for, to use a bad word.
I was going to say kosher might not be the best word.
But really, it's very problematic for a Muslim. You're not supposed to take your own life. And the sort of the allowance for suicide bombing is just very, very small exception that's allowed for in Islam. And Zarqawi just trampled over that line, burning people alive, killing innocent Muslims. All these things are forbidden. But what Zarqawi did very creatively, because he didn't know the Quran very well, is to just make up his own rules and get somebody to give him religious cover, to sort of issue the fatwa, to make it okay, ideologically, to do these things. And so, this is where Baghdadi makes his rise to the ranks. He is a religious scholar. He's actually a professor of Islamic law, of Sharia law. He got his degree at the University of Baghdad. So he comes along, and he's the kind of guy that, he'll sanction whatever he's told. And just through a series of, again, accidents, these guys sometimes just fall into leadership positions unexpectedly. Number one and number two keep getting knocked off, and Baghdadi moves up and up and up. And by 2010, he ends up in the leadership. It turns out he's just as cold-blooded as Zarqawi was, but because he's a religious scholar and because he has lineage to Muhammad, he has a special stature within the organization. He becomes the caliph. He becomes the leader of this Islamic state that they want to build. Very much like Zarqawi, he has a prison experience as a young man. He was captured by the Americans, put into what really becomes a jihadist university, which is a big warehouse for these young radical men. They feed off each other. They learn contacts. They learn techniques, and that becomes a formative experience in his life. So later on, when he gets an opportunity to lead, he's radical. He's angry, and he's got the connections to move into the leadership.
I'd like to ask a couple of policy questions that I think a lot of people might be interested in, given how incredibly detailed your knowledge is of these. One of the questions debated in very often in the press is, to which policy error by the United States do you ascribe the greatest blame? And let me just offer four of the many dozens that could be offered. The original invasion of Iraq, the withdrawal from Iraq in 2010, the hesitance to get involved in Syria. Well, let's take those three.
Well, and I think also there's the dismantling of the Iraqi military infrastructure.
And the de-Bethification
program. And, you know, do I have to pick one?
You can answer all of the above.
I think they're all important. And so we can be so equal opportunity and nonpartisan here. I think you can find fault in administration policies for both administrations. I do think that sort of the original sin, and maybe the proximate cause for the rise of the stimulation of this movement was the Iraq invasion, because that had that not happened, and assuming that Saddam Hussein would have remained in control in Iraq, which is horrible for whatever reasons or multiple reasons, but he certainly had a handle on any religious insurgency in this country, so that wouldn't have happened. All kinds of other things that sort of the de-evolution of the region probably wouldn't have happened. So that was a really big deal. We can very fairly, I think, you know, fast forward to what happened since 2009 when President Obama came into office. And I think there's a really interesting debate about whether we had to get out of Iraq in 2010. Could we have left a residual troop force there? The Iraqis didn't want us to. I think it's pretty clear to say Maliki made it very, very hard for us to try to stay and put up all kinds of objections and resistance. It's argued by even some allies of President Obama that if we would have used more pressure, used more leverage, we might have been able to keep a small force of 10,000 in Iraq, and that may have made a difference in preventing the rise of this organization. What did happen after we withdrew is two things. One, Maliki did what he wanted to do, which essentially become this super Shia strongman, right, repress the Sunnis, arrest their leaders, essentially drive all these Sunnis who had been on our side, been sort of the Anbar Awakening, the Sons of Iraq, all these guys who had been tribal leaders who were fighting against the terrorists, suddenly they all started going back the other way and thinking, well, anything's better than Maliki. So you see tribal leaders joining forces or aligning themselves with Al-Qaeda in Iraq and with ISIS. And I've talked to many of these tribal leaders who would tell me, ISIS is bad, but we can control them. We need the sort of the firepower. We need their discipline. So we're gonna let them in the back door, and then after they're in and we've pushed Maliki out, we're gonna just control them. And they had absolutely no ability to do that. And of course, the other thing that happened was once the Syrian conflict took place, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, ISIS had this opportunity to regrow, to sort of resurrect and have not just a vacuum and sort of the opportunities that came from the Civil War, but they had a cause suddenly. It wasn't just they're not fighting Americans anymore. They're fighting a really bad dictator. And so that became a reason for people to go from around the world to join ISIS. And we, as a government, thought about trying to do more to bring the Civil War to a conclusion. We got blocked in many instances by the Russians, but we were also very reluctant to get involved militarily. There were big debates within the cabinet about whether or not it was wise to arm rebels. I mean, when is it, you know, Obama kept saying, when has it ever been useful for us to get involved in a civil war? How has it ever ended well? So that was the argument he made. And we essentially stood back and as we were kind of watching this conflict, it just grew into this monster, which allowed ISIS to become even bigger and more powerful than anyone could have ever anticipated.
And in combination between ISIS and the government of Bashar al-Assad, kill some 450,000
incredible
Syrians and make another 11 million refugees.
One of the great tragedies of our time.
What's your judgment about the fresh ceasefire negotiation that Secretary Kerry and Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov have been engaged in. Does it seem to you a good idea? Do you fear that it makes us complicit in the war crimes that the Assad and the Russian governments are engaged in? Give us your perspective.
Yeah. Well, for one thing, it's about time. I mean, this has been tried before. The Russians, for various reasons, have really not followed through on their promises. They've not put the pressure on the Assad regime that they should have. One of my personal foibles is I tend to get optimistic sometimes, and it's just completely unwarranted.
Covering yes. national security in the Middle East.
I think it's just such a dreary situation. You just want to be like, gosh, maybe it'll work this time. And that's, there are a few things that make me feel like maybe they're onto something. I mean, what the deal is now, if you've been following the news, you're well aware of this, but there is a ceasefire. It seems to be holding so far with some violations. We're supporting it, the Russians supporting it, Assad is bought into it, Hezbollah, it's a lot of unsavory characters have bought into it. A lot of the rebels have not, so it's certainly not universal. But if it holds, there's this hope that then the United States and Russia are going to coordinate more carefully on policy. They're going to try to decide who they can attack in terms of rebel groups, which ones are actually constructive members of the opposition. The Russians will leave them alone. They're promising right now. We'll see if that actually happens. And then a negotiation begins or restarts. And God knows we've tried this. We've gone down this road. But really the only hope for stopping ISIS and really addressing the root causes of these problems is to bring this conflict to an end. So will it bring that result? Will the Russians actually bring about a new government that doesn't have a guy named Assad leading it? I like to think so, but maybe that just might be the crazy optimist in me, but at least it's progress in the way that we haven't had for a long time.
If you could design an American strategy for the decline of ISIS.
That's the sequel.
Give us an insight into your next book then. Yeah. What's the decline of ISIS look like? What's a strategy that you think would actually be acceptable to this president or the next one, one that doesn't make the same kinds of mistakes we have made so frequently in the region, and one that would actually solve this problem in a way that defangs the metastasization that we have seen and that your book describes so awfully well.
Well, thank you for that. But a couple of key points. One is the caliphate has to be brought to an end for multiple reasons. If you want to get rid of the problem, you have to get rid of the caliphate first, because this is dangerous as a physical entity, because these guys have the opportunity to plan and plot and send emissaries around the world to do terrible things. But it also, it's part of the mythology that ISIS has created. They get people to join them because people buy into this idea that this is a great sea change in history, that we have this restoration of what was, the Islamic world once had, which was its own religious caliphate, which spread across the entire Middle East. It's been a long time since they had it, but the whole concept of ISIS really is we create this thing and you build it, they will come. And so they've been able to attract professionals, not just criminals and malcontents, but people who are pious Muslims who really believe in this idea that this caliphate is meant to happen. So you have to get rid of that as a symbol and as a practical matter. But then beyond that, in eliminating the caliphate, we have to be very careful, because, discussion of carpet bombing, that's a very bad idea, because there are many civilians who would get killed in the process, and everyone that we kill, every innocent Muslim we kill, is a huge strike against us, because we need these people on our side. We need to prevent sort of the seeds of the next conflict from taking place. So all these, I think, are pretty self-explanatory. The one thing I want to mention that maybe people don't think about as much is, fast forward in your minds for a moment to what happens once the caliphate falls, and you have Iraq and Syria no longer under ISIS. There are all these cities that have to be rebuilt. There are all these children and families, and we're actually working on talking to these kids now and listening to their stories. These kids, some of them have been in ISIS training camps. The ones who weren't in training camps have witnessed incredible brutality. Who's going to provide the kind of counseling for these people? Who's going to offer them hope, schools, you know, the prospects for a job someday? It's a huge undertaking, and it's going to take, you know, a generation to begin to address these problems. But if we don't, if we walk away like we did in Afghanistan, you can just guarantee that the seeds of the next conflict are already there, and it's just going to get worse. It's going to be Afghanistan all over again in the 1990s, but much worse because it's in the heart of the Middle East, right next door to our allies, Israel, Jordan, and it's going to be, I think, even worse than the situation we're in right now.
It seems to me such a mystery that we are losing the social media campaign against a group of people who are bloodthirsty murderers, and we're the society that has Hollywood, Madison Avenue, the 24-hour news cycle, Silicon Valley. How is it that we are not competitive in this space?
Yeah. Every now and then you do have to tip your hat to the adversary. They are really good in this space. And they're good because they react to things in minutes and hours. It takes us much longer because it's government, for goodness sake, and you know budgets and all kinds of other considerations get involved. And so it's days and weeks before we can counter a message that's out there. We're getting pretty good now about leaning on our corporate friends, the Googles and the Twitters and others, to be very proactive in trying to take down this propaganda. But we're really slow in reacting to it. And just in the messaging itself, you know, ISIS is good because they spend a lot of time thinking about this. They produce very slick material. I mean, these awful videos that you see, it's not some guy with a cell phone camera. It's three or four professional videographers taking the same scene from different perspectives and then mixing it up with a professional studio, which they have in Raqqa. And it comes out being something as slick as you'd see the U.S. Army produce. So they're really, really good at messaging, and they've been way ahead of us from the beginning. The other problem, unfortunately, is our standing in challenging them on ideological grounds is not very good at all. They don't take us seriously. They don't think we know what we're talking about. And coming from the West, our messages really don't mean very much. It has to come from other Muslims.
Mm-hmm. So the first of the questions from our participants is, what role could and should multilateral institutions like NATO and the UN play in defeating ISIS? Mm.
The more international we can make this, the better off we are. I mean, our problem in Iraq was it was us. Everybody knew it was us. We had allies and friends who were there, but it was really an American operation. This has to be, you know, just you think back to the first Gulf War and this sort of coalition of you know, scores of countries from around the world, including countries like Syria, who were on our side in that conflict. So the more we can make this international and the more we can involve other Muslim Arab countries, it just better optic, but also just more effective in bringing about a solution. It's unwieldy, it's cumbersome, because you get a committee instead of one sort of powerful presence getting things done. But just to make this work and to make it permanent, it has to be a large coalition and not just a single figurehead at the front of it.
The next question is to ask your assessment of drone strikes on ISIS. So weighing the advantage of killing bad guys against the obvious unhappiness that a lot of countries have about us operating drone strikes in their territory.
This is something I actually covered from the earliest days when we started using armed drones in Afghanistan. And I remember the guys who first proposed this as a solution. They thought this was going to be the most controversial thing that any administration had ever done. The idea of sending a weapon, you know, aircraft to a country that we weren't officially at war with and killing, you know, civilians without any kind of due process was just going to just drive people in this country crazy. It turned out it didn't happen. The outcry was there, but it wasn't nearly as pronounced as people expected it to be. Now we're used to it. Now we accept it as kind of the way that these wars are waged. And so you can debate, you know, is it moral? Is it you know, the right policy for this country to take? It certainly is, you know, counterproductive in the sense that every time we strike, an enemy in this way, it builds resentments. It's a recruitment tool and that sort of thing. But what you have to also say is it has been effective. And just in the last couple of weeks, we took out the number two leader of ISIS, a guy named Adnani, who was the spokesman for the group, also their chief operations planner. We've taken out their chief military commander. It's, you know, they always manage to replace these people when we take them out. But when you do eliminate a leader, it puts them back on their heels. It disrupts their plans. It also makes them very nervous. I remember looking at through the documents in Abbottabad after Bin Laden was killed. We had this whole trove of material that we ended up harvesting, and the extent to which these terrorist leaders were worried daily about the fact that they could, you know, be killed overnight, it really affected them. It kept them pinned down to their houses. It kept preventing them from talking with each other. It limited their ambition. So in that sense, you can argue the morality of it, you can argue the policy, but it has been effective in its own way.
You're listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. I'm Jane Wales, CEO. We're hearing from Joby Warrick. He's a Washington Post reporter and the author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS. He's in conversation with Corey Shockey, senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And now back to our conversation.
The next question from our audience is, George Bush said Islam is peaceful, and Barack Obama said ISIS is not Islamic. However, there are verses in the Quran that say non-Muslims should be killed or enslaved. Isn't the problem Islam itself? Aren't terrorists the true Muslims?
That's a good question. I'm glad that the writer mentioned President Bush's speeches. I just actually reread his address to Congress from September 20, 2001, so like 11 days after the 9/11 attacks. Did I get that right? But yeah, he specifically went out of his way to say, this is not a war against Muslims. This is a war against this radical fringe, which we abhor, which is not compatible with Western civilization, but it's not, we're not, you know, going to war against our Muslim allies. You know, there are passages in the Quran and in the Hadith that we find repugnant. But as a minister's kid who's very familiar with the Bible, you can find just as many in the Old Testament, certainly, and maybe some in the New Testament too. But what's different about our civilization, our version of civilization, is we ended up moving beyond that. We don't take those, most of us don't take those prescriptions seriously anymore. We don't stone people caught in adultery or kids who dishonor their mother and father, so that we as a civilized society have moved beyond those kinds of very strict interpretations of scripture. And we also have this thing called separation of church and state, or separation of religion and state. And that, to us, seems very natural. I think the Muslim world hasn't figured out that relationship yet, because there is this sense where, you know, faith is very tied into governance, and the fact that you should have a secular government that can contradict, you know, religious principles, that's a very hard thing for many people in that part of the world to accept or understand. And that's why Jeffersonian democracy is really a difficult thing for these guys to achieve, because they haven't figured out that relationship. I think it's going to be another generation before they do. Mm-hmm. But I do think the one thing that's really dangerous is we do have good allies in the Arab world who are on our side in this fight, because they're suffering and dying much more than we are from ISIS. And they look at this group. I've met with the King of Jordan many times, and there's an Arab word called, I think, Khawaji, I think is some pronouncing it correct, but it's basically saying, these guys aren't really Muslims, they're outlaws, they're heretics. We've seen these in the past, in Islam's past, and we need to distance ourselves, we need to denounce them, we have to explain to the world, this is not who Muslims are. And so that message needs to be repeated and repeated and repeated, and not just by moderates like him, but by the Saudi leaders and others who really have influence and can sway public opinion. Mm.
The next question is, given the history of the U.S. and the West as a meddling imperialist power in the Middle East, is it really our place to get more directly involved? Could the U.S. not just support other groups like the Kurds in Syria and Iraq in their fight?
Mm. Boy, we're in San Francisco, aren't we? So, no, just detect just a bit of an edge to the...
Was it the history of imperialism that touched you off?
But you know, that's it. Absolutely, it's a very valid point. And should we just walk away? And one wonders that sometimes. And we look at our dependence on Middle Eastern oil. That actually is very much diminished from where it used to be. We're the biggest oil producer suddenly. Our traditional allies, we have more problems with than we did previously. But the unfortunate reality is we still remain the sole superpower. And for us to expect that the rest of the world can do this without us, it's probably just not going to happen. The victories we're winning right now in Iraq and Syria are taking place because we have managed to get the Kurds and an Iraqi force and some Arab moderate Arabs working with us on the ground to do sort of the heavy fighting while we go in, do special operations stuff, the intelligence, the sort of the, you know, the airstrikes. And that's a pretty successful formula. If you think back at how did we win the Afghan conflict in 2001 so quickly, we didn't do it with our troops. We did it with Afghan militias, a few special forces guys, a few dozen, and air power. And that was the formula that was very successful in a matter of months of chasing out the Al-Qaeda and taking down the Taliban government. And same thing in Iraq. I think the surge was important in finally getting the control of that terrible situation in 2007 and 8. But it was really the Iraqi citizens, the tribes, the Sunni tribes who finally had enough of Zarqawi and his people and began to fight them. That was really the turning point. So we need those people on our side, and we can help direct them, we can help give them resources, but we can't do it without them.
Next question from the audience is Russia really interested in Syria? My theory is that they entered the conflict to destabilize Europe. Bombing increases, migration increases, EU policy splinters, Brexit. Is it possible that Russia just got lucky in Syria?
It's probably given Russia more credit than even they deserve. And they certainly are Machiavellian. I think their biggest concern really, first of it's a pride issue for them. They've got one serious ally in the Middle East, and that was Assad. They've got one warm water Navy port in that region. It's in Syria. So it's a very important place to them. And they also, if you just recall where this happened in history, they had been, say so, had kind of roped into letting us intervene in Libya. They didn't want to see that happen, but it happened, and we chased out Gaddafi, who had, you know, it was very problematic for them. So they had, just as a matter of pride, they did not want to see that same thing happen in Syria, and so they put up all kinds of obstacles. They blocked every reasonable resolution at the UN to even sanction or condemn what Assad was doing to his own people. So they've just been, unhelpful to say the least from the very beginning. And now I think they're just enjoying the problems they're creating for us, because they don't see us as being on the same side in any sense. We're adversaries to them. And I think it's a personal issue for Putin. I think he just feels like he wants to assert himself, you know, show himself to be this great global leader, and this is his platform. He's even reaching out to try to fix the Palestinian-Israeli problem now. Good luck with that. But he's inserting himself into that region in a way we haven't seen the Russians do for decades, and it's troubling. Mm-hmm.
This questioner, like many others, wrote that they love your book.
Oh,
so
my kids, thank you.
It's the college fund.
Yeah, that's right. I've got one sophomore right now. So
the question is to ask your perspective on whether ISIL will focus on Iraq if the ceasefire is effective in Syria.
They do have a way of, and I guess this is just smart strategy, of trying to keep the Iraqis off balance. Every time there is a success in going, approaching Mosul or overtaking Ramadi or whatever, that's when they strike, and that's when they blow up a shopping mall in Baghdad and kill 200 people, and they force the Iraqis to go back and strengthen security in the capital. They start aggravating the Sunni-Shia divide again, so Sunnis don't really want to fight with, work with the Shia government. So I wouldn't be surprised if that happens. I think ISIS is at a stage right now where they're looking for any way to show that they're still powerful. They haven't had a military success to speak of since they took over Palmyra in the spring of 2015. Ever since then, it's been a steady retreat. They've been losing ground. They've been losing leaders. And so any opportunity for them to show themselves to be potent still, they'll take advantage of that opportunity. And that includes strikes in Europe or even in the United States if they get the opportunity to do that.
Several of the next tranche of questions focus on the role of the Kurds and the role of Turkey. Could you shift your regional focus a little bit that direction to talk about the role of the Kurds, the recent Turkish military actions in northern Syria, and the kind of future status of Turkey, given the amount of friction that the Syrian war has caused in the Turkish-American relationship?
And this is one of those questions where you really do think, well, maybe we should just quit and go home, because this is when it gets so incredibly complicated. I mean, the best fighters on the ground on our side are the Kurds. But every time they start to get, take over some territory, then the Turks get nervous and they start lobbing some shells and start attacking Kurdish positions, attacking our allies. And of course, we're fellow NATO members with Turkey and supposedly allies with them too. So it's just one of the many, many layers of complication in trying to resolve this thing. The Turks do not want to see an independent or Kurdish state, certainly, and they don't want to see a strong Kurdish region. The Iraqis have the same concerns. So that's, we're going to need some really smart diplomacy to try to sort this out without getting people just killing each other. I had a colleague just a few weeks ago who wrote an interesting article about 10 wars that could be started by the current one we're in, that you could see follow-on conflicts taking place after the ISIS thing is done. And one of them is a Kurdish-Turkish conflict, an expanded shooting war between those sides. So it's just one of many, many things that go wrong. It's very distressful to see what's happening in Turkey now. It was this one country that, after the Ataturk revolution back in, early in the last century, they developed this model of being a Muslim country that was essentially secular. And now, after this latest coup, it's moved so far the other way. It's becoming a Muslim Brotherhood state. Yeah. And that's really where Erdogan wants it to be. And he's being, he's as much a target of ISIS as anyone else these days. But he's moved so far in that direction, and it's in some cases completely at odds with our policies. It's just hard to see how it's going to come back.
Yeah, the friction between democratization and Islamization in Egypt, in Turkey, and several other countries that are trying to move away from an authoritarian past, I think it's been a surprise how strong, how well-organized Islamist political parties are to take advantage of that transition in several of the countries.
Yeah, you're right, because they're really the only organized movement or political movement in these countries, like in Egypt in particular. There was some tolerance for the Muslim Brotherhood to exist as an organization, so they have an overt network and also usually an underground network as well that makes them very powerful. And the story of Arab Spring was those democratic aspirations and for a moment a flicker of hope that some of these countries could actually develop some form of democracy that we'd be comfortable with, and yet very quickly some of the Islamist groups hijacked those democratic aspirations. And we could argue that they were the strongest democratic force anyway, and maybe they by right should have won, but their interests are often very different from our own.
Yeah, and the countervailing force of the fact that the fragility and incapacity of governance in so many of the countries in the region creates a frustration that actually feeds the jihadist narrative that peaceful political change is impossible. Violence is the only way to change the status quo.
Yeah, absolutely.
Which takes us to the next question from the audience related to that, which is, how does corruption fit into the story you're telling?
A couple of things on that. When you talked about this sort of underlying unhappiness in that part of the world, nobody usually claims they join ISIS because of they don't feel they have political opportunities or because there's corruption in their societies. But if you dig down a layer or two, that's part of the frustration for these young people. They don't see a future for themselves in their countries because they don't have an opportunity for political expression. They feel that everything is rigged because their societies have such endemic corruption, and it really is a problem. And so here's a chance for them to be empowered by this Islamist organization. So that's why they often go that direction. You talk about corruption. It's often ISIS is so hypocritical because they tend to be the most corrupt of all. Zarqawi was really good at self-funding because he was a master at black market dealing. He was selling goods. He was shaking down businesses. you know, very directly, you know, making no, you know, nothing secretive about it, but just he was a thug. And so he continued to be a thug as the leader of an Islamist organization. And ISIS today has that same pattern. They, you know, they have oil wells, they have some oil assets. Who do they sell the oil to? Well, they find corrupt people in Turkey and Syria, and that's their business partners. Mm-hmm. And so the corruption is just everywhere. And if you you try to claim it's just the despots that do it, it's just not the case.
Yeah. The next question from the audience is about cutting off ISIS's funding. It sounds like from your answer to the previous question that it's inseparable from taking the territory of the caliphate. Mm. But do I impute too much into your answer? Well, what would you say? Yeah, are there ways we can cut their funding?
We've worked on a bunch of them, and one, of course, is trying to limit the oil trade, which they've relied on for lots of their money. When you shrink their territory, they've got fewer people to tax, fewer businesses to shake down, so they actually are losing some of the revenue that way. My favorite thing we've been doing is, as you may recall, when ISIS overran big cities in Iraq, like Mosul, one of the things they got out of that was banks, and literally hundreds of millions of dollars of hard currency just fell into their lap. And we figured out where some of that was because of our intelligence. And so one of the more fun military attacks have been the ones that have gone after the cash depots. So you've seen literally hundreds of millions of dollars go up in flames. You could just hear the screams of despair from ISIS because they're blowing up their hard currency, which they need to pay their troops and buy stuff. And so we have put a hurt on their finances. They don't need that much to do bad stuff, though. The estimate for the cost, so the raw cost of the Paris attack in November, is about $10,000. Doesn't take much.
Doesn't take much. The next question is about the role of Saudi Arabia in spreading Wahhabism and fueling Islamic terrorism. What should the U.S. do about Saudi Arabia?
You know, one little data point, which I just think is striking, when ISIS moved into some of the territories that it occupies, it restarts schools and has a very strong belief in educating the new generation. But, of course, ISIS didn't have its own textbooks, but it was very happy to use standard Saudi texts to teach children religion, to teach them ideology, because the basic Wahhabi tradition, which is their sort of strain of or variation of Sunni Islam, is called Wahhabism. It's very conservative, and it's really the core ideology that ISIS and al-Qaeda follow. It essentially means, it sort of harkens back to the very earliest days of Islam, thinks that all innovations, all theological innovations are invalid, that you have to do exactly like the early leaders of the movement did, which means essentially a medieval period and sort of medieval approach to the world. Mm-hmm. Thing is this is really interesting marriage in Saudi Arabia between the royal family and the Wahhabi spiritual leaders has been a big problem for us because the oil has allowed the Wahhabis to spread their doctrine throughout the world. They've managed to build mosques pretty much everywhere. I was just in Albania a few months ago. And the story with that country, here's a country that was under communism for decades. Religion was essentially outlawed. It's a Muslim-majority country, but they weren't really very serious Muslims because they had no tradition for decades of having any religious education or culture. After communism falls, the Saudis send in missionaries, they send in millions of dollars to build mosques, they find very promising young people, bring them to Mecca for training, and so you see this suddenly a generation of very radical and radicalized, you know, very conservative young Albanian Muslims who are that way because our good friends the Saudis converted them. And some of those individuals are the ones that have gone to ISIS to fight, and they have their own little Albanian brigade there today.
The one footnote I would add to that is just the reminder that in the Reagan administration, we had actually encouraged the Saudis to spread religion because we viewed it as an anti-communist bulwark.
Yeah.
And so, especially in Afghanistan, a very good book on this subject by Rachel Bronson called Thicker Than Oil. It's a history of the U.S.-Saudi relationship. It's a very good book and tracks the the extent to which we bear some culpability for the Saudi propagation of a strain of Islam with which we are really struggling right now.
You never have to scratch back that far to find some hint of a U.S. assistance in some of these things.
The next question is, what do you think the chances are of Iraq being partitioned into several states, and do you think it would be effective? So assess the Biden plan, please.
Yeah. I think Biden's right, and I just because, you know, from my travels to the region, it is so hard to imagine these people, you know, ever being able to put it back together again. It just, there's so much, and it's just like you think of Syria. How could the Sunnis ever exist under an Assad government? There's just too many horrible things have happened. And there's just, nobody you talk to seems hopeful of any kind of unity government or, you know, bringing the forces together. At the very least, I think there's going to have to be, you know, a confederacy that allows these regions to be very much autonomous. That gets to be a problem because who gets the oil? You know, the Sunnis live in one of the, essentially the most resource poor part of the country, so they're going to feel like they've been left out. And then if that is the case, so you have this poor Sunni region, then that becomes once again a potential hotbed for terrorism or insurgency. So there's no good easy answers for any of this, but the one thing is for sure is these, so the prospects for a united Iraq are very dim, I think.
Yeah. Let me ask a follow-up question about that, though, because you just gave a terrific answer about the internal nature of the conversation. But I went to work for General Powell when he was chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff in the summer of 1990, right after Iraq invaded Kuwait. And early on in my job, I was a note taker at a meeting between him and his Turkish counterpart. And his Turkish counterpart explained to him that if we were going to throw Iraq out of Kuwait, but we needed to leave Saddam Hussein in power, because if Saddam Hussein left, Iraq would fracture into sectarian pieces, and Turkey would have to take the northern third of it so that an autonomous Kurdish state wouldn't emerge.
Wow.
So let me ask you to walk around Iraq's neighbors. What do you think the likely reaction is, not of the Turks, but say of the Syrians or Jordanians, if you get a fracture of that kind?
You know, so many horrifying things to contemplate there. You know, it just, to me, what all that just reminds me of is the fact that this is a region filled with countries that were created by colonial powers out of whole cloth. It's essentially, the Ottoman Empire falls, you know, is taken down at the end of World War I, and France and Britain sit down with a map and a crayon and essentially say, well, we're going to draw this line here, and we're going to create this country here. Jordan never exists. There's no Jordan country in history. There's no Jordanian nationality historically. But we owed a favor to one of the sheikhs that helped us fight the Turks, part of the Arab revolt. And so we created a Transjordan, a new country that didn't exist before. You know, one of the things that ISIS wants to do, interestingly, is erase all those lines. That treaty that created all these countries. It's called the Sykes-Picot Treaty. They think is an abomination and should be eliminated. But you kind of have to see their point in the sense that a lot of these countries don't really make sense, because when these maps are drawn, there's no respect for boundaries of sectarian groups or religious groups, and it's hard to draw those maps anyway. But there's, now you've got just countries that have just built-in conflict, and when you try to take them apart, then you've got other problems that you've got to deal with. You know, is Iraq really going to let itself be dismantled? Will Baghdad sit still for that? And that's just a hornet's nest.
Jordan is, I think, one of the most inspiring cases. When my hope for the future of the Middle East begins to flag, Jordan is what takes me back to more optimistic space, in that you're right, it's a completely manufactured country. And yet, they not only have taken in something like 5 million Syrian refugees, but during the formation of the State of Israel, Jordan took in Palestinian refugees who now constitute almost half of the population.
Yeah.
And they make it work.
Yeah.
They've managed to defang political Islam to the point where the Muslim Brotherhood serves in the parliament.
Yeah.
What is it that Jordan's able to do right that other countries in the region haven't mastered?
Yeah. For one, they've got, I do think they have benign leadership. It is a monarchy. King Hussein was a I think a wise leader who essentially, and a lot of those Syrians didn't go to refugee camps. A lot of them went into cities, and they're competing for houses, and they're competing for limited resources. It's a country that doesn't have nearly enough water for its own people. Now it's got to share with a million more hungry mouths. It doesn't have any energy resources. Now it's going to get some maybe from the Israelis with this new Mediterranean pipeline, but it struggles just to pay the rent essentially every year. Its friends are fickle in the region. We promise a lot. A lot of times our aid is slower than it should be. We don't give them the kinds of weapons they ask for, but they're in the front lines in the ISIS fight every day, but they still drop dumb bombs because we don't trust them with more sophisticated weapons. So I do feel like the Jordanians have been great friends, and we haven't always treated them that way. And if that country falls, or if that leadership falls, it's hard to imagine that what comes next would be an improvement.
Mm-hmm. I am actually surprised we got this far into our conversation without the subject of Iran coming up.
Oh, wow. We can stop now.
Yeah, never take the last question. Let me ask you in our closing few minutes to reflect on the role of Iran and the narrative about Iran that other countries in the region tell, which is that we have been predominantly worried about Iran's nuclear weapons program, and they are worried about it, but they may be even more worried about Iran's support for terrorism, mm-hmm. arming Hezbollah and Hamas, destabilizing countries in the region, Bahrain, Yemen, Iraq, most importantly. Is Iran that malevolent an actor, and if so, what should countries in the region be doing about it that they're not?
Yeah, that's an awfully good question. Our biggest concern as a country has been the nuclear program, because that's the one that we worry most about. And so that's why the administration put all this emphasis and effort in trying to get this nuclear deal. The others in the region see other things, and they worry about support for Hezbollah. The Israelis certainly see that as their biggest concern. They see IRGC, the Revolutionary Guard cadres, just making mischief everywhere from Yemen, meddling in internal affairs. They've got a very active intelligence service that keeps stirring up things, trying to get Shiites in Bahrain agitated and fighting against their government, the Shiites in eastern Saudi Arabia stirred up. So they see Iran is a big troublemaker in the region, and they're more worried about seeing a resurgent, prosperous, increasingly ambitious Iran as kind of the biggest security threat to the region. If you look further down the road, what's interesting to me is Iran is not a monolith, and we think of them as being all malevolent, but there are different factions within Iran. And the current, president, Rouhani and Zarif are actually, it seems to me, to be much more interested in getting Iran reintegrated with the rest of the world. They really pushed hard for this nuclear deal, even though the conservatives in their country didn't want it at all. And what part of our calculus and part of the calculus for our allies has to be, we want to encourage that part of Iranian governance, because there is some potential there. And it may be, in a few years, Khamenei dies. He's an old man. The last of those revolutionary leaders are going to pass away. What comes next? Can we shape that next generation of Iranian leadership? Are there positive ways we can engage with them instead of just thinking of them as being bad guys? Because they are a big power in the region, and they're going to continue to be no matter what we do.
So, my friends, thank you so much for showing up this evening to celebrate and learn from the great Joby Warrick, author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS.
You've been listening to World Affairs, the weekly broadcast of the World Affairs Council. Ours is a membership organization. We're dedicated to engaging the public in conversations that matter. You can visit us at worldaffairs.org. In this week's conversation, we've just heard from Joby Warrick. He's author of Black Flags, The Rise of ISIS, and is a prize-winning reporter at The Washington Post. Joining him in conversation was Corey Shockey of the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. To share this episode, or register for upcoming events, or to join the World Affairs Council, Visit us at worldaffairs.org. This broadcast is made possible weekly by the generous support of Chevron. Additional funding for post-production is provided by Maria Starr. She's a member of the KQED Producer Circle. Our recording engineer is Jim Bennett. Our technical supervisor is Monte Carlos. World Affairs is produced in association with KQED Public Radio. I'm Jane Wales. Thank you for joining us.